Welcome to Crosstalk, the number one podcast on the face of the earth, as everybody might know by now, to find out how to live balanced, inspired, and sober one day at a time. I'm really excited today. We have a guest who's traveled from both Colorado and Lenox, Massachusetts, to be in our studio in New York City. And I want to help a real big New York City welcome for Tanya Gioia. Welcome, Tanya.
Thanks, Corey. I'm not sure what a New York City welcome is. I hope it's not a Bronx cheer because
actually, we have the cops outside.
I already tried to leave once.
Right? Yeah, I locked the door. They can't get in right now. As soon as we're finished, you're out of here.
Thanks, Corey. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I love the work you and Irene are doing and all the things that go into that. And that you're doing it live. It's so much different than doing it when we are on computer screen.
Right. Well, I'm really excited to have you here. Most of the time, our interviews have been interviewing folks that have been in alcohol and drug recovery over either a one-year period of time, or we had Todd was here, had 50 years, celebrated his 50th anniversary in our studio. I was really honored that he came on his anniversary date to be with us. But we're starting to expand a little bit and go into other areas, areas that are really very integrally related to recovery. And today we're going to be talking to you because you are a recovery coach, primarily for women. Mm-hmm. And you deal with the subject of codependence. Mm-hmm. And I have a really good friend of mine who's actually a loan officer at a bank that my firm does business with. And she said, you know, Corey, you really got to get some people who know more about the other side of things. I want to hear about people that I can relate to, not just the people my husband can relate to. I want to get some support. I want to get some guidance. I want to hear more from people who know about what it's like to be the other side of a addictive relationship so that people feel a little bit more that we're bringing a balanced message. So I'm really excited to be listening and learning from you. And why don't we start out with a little bit about you and your background personally, and then we can go into what you do as a coach for women.
Absolutely. I tell two different stories, one of which is, if I was sitting in a room with 50 good-looking men, right, and all of them are equally good-looking, everything is fine, my choice would be the one who's living at home with his mother, doesn't have a job, is addicted to something, and that I can manipulate and move around for my own particular issues. So you might look at me and say, well, she has a relationship addiction, or she has a love addiction, or she loves too much, or those types of things. As I grew in that, what I realized was, no, I didn't have three key things. I didn't understand that I was loved. I didn't understand that I was worthy and that I was never alone. And so we've got to back up into my Christian faith, and my understanding was, even though I grew up in the church, I didn't quite get it. So I was looking for a male who could fulfill me. And I have to tell you, one of my pet peeves is the Jerry Maguire movie. You and I are old enough to have seen the Jerry Maguire movie. And he comes in and he says, "You complete me. I just want to throw things at the screen." I'm like, if I am looking for another human to complete me, I'm in the totally wrong place. So in asking for somebody else to complete me, I am asking for them, in my faith understanding, to come up to this godlike level, be there every time I need them, do the right thing, be available, be there. Because do you want to hear the crazy circle?
Sure.
Okay, here's the crazy circle. If you are happy, then I'm happy. Then it becomes my job to keep you happy. Then if I can't keep you happy, I have to control all the situation and everything around it to keep you happy. So then my job becomes to fix you. So not only am I looking for you to be my savior, I am responsible for being your savior, because if you're not happy, then I can't be happy.
So instead of you complete me, from Tom Cruise's famous line in the movie Jerry Maguire, what's a better way to look at a healthy connection between two people? Can you restate what you might want him to say in that movie?
I can tell you, that's a very good question. And I hadn't thought what I would want him to say, because I've been so angry at what he did say. But here's how I look at it. is what he's saying is, I have holes, you have holes, let's get a mesh and try and fix those holes together, which just becomes this mash, right? What I believe God said was, I created man and I created woman. Both of you are whole. And when you come together to form one entity, you are bringing two wholes, not two halves to form a whole, but two wholes to come together and create something new. So I'm bringing what's good about me, what's difficult about me. You're bringing what's good about you and what's difficult about you. And then we form this triangle with God to create something that becomes a whole. So what I was doing was looking for that man. To me, it's almost like the perfect pair of shoes. Looking for that man that could do everything. And I kept failing. I have a failed marriage. The marriage that I've been married 20 years in now, we had to separate for 23 months to get our lives back together. But it wasn't in us and them. What I began to realize was, if you really looked at me, I had more issues, more struggles, more problems. He was solving his. Right? What do drugs and alcohol do? They temporarily solve the issue. He was solving his. I was trying to solve mine by controlling him.
He was solving his by using?
Right.
Self-medicating.
Correct. Because why do we use anything? We don't do it because it doesn't work. We do it because it does work. So temporarily, and that's, we'll bring in Gabor Mate early of, it's a behavior that temporarily solves, addiction is a behavior that temporarily solves the emotional, spiritual, physical, whatever is going on, but has long-term consequences, negative consequences for your life after it has temporarily solved it.
You know, you bring up Gabor Mate. Before we started our interview, we talked a little bit about him.
Yep.
And I remember a quote of his, and I think I might have mentioned it before, on Crosstalk, he said, it's hard to get enough of something that almost works.
Yes. And so you're looking at me and I'm drinking in these men that I'm with, like you would drink in an alcohol, right? So say he comes home and we have a great time together, then I don't want him to leave. I don't even want him to go to work. I don't want him to do the things that are healthy for him to do, because that doesn't feed me in the way that I perceived I needed to be fed. So when Gabor Mate talks about this, he doesn't even say, you know, how long have you been using? What have you been doing? He said, what need is it filling? What are you getting from it? What do you value about it? Because the underneath question is, where's the pain? The pain was, I didn't feel worthy, I didn't feel loved, and I felt alone.
So at what point did something hit you upside the head and you decided you wanted to make some changes?
I wish I was that smart. So, and you know, I have a graduate degree and I have all of those things. I had been married once before. My beautiful husband said to me, well, I smoke a little pot. And I said, okay, let's give it a roll. Now, if I already knew I didn't want somebody who had a substance use issue disorder, then I probably should have said no. But we're having a great time. It's a wonderful summer on a guest ranch. We're riding horses. He's cooking. I'm managing the barn. We're having a great time. And we go to get married. And I said, well, you would need to quit before I get married. The naivete about addiction was just over my head. So when we finally did... When I finally did say, okay, something has to be done, I did what I think a lot of people do with 12 steps is I said, okay, this is controlling. Remember, I need to keep him happy, so I'm happy. Okay, you go to AA. I'll go to Al-Anon. I walked in. There's 12 steps, 12 months, piece of cake. We're out of here, right?
Wait a minute. There's 12 months. Is that a requirement, 12 months? I didn't hear that.
I know. I'm supposed to be done with one each month. No, it took me 16 hours to do my fourth step. We met for four different four-hour sessions to do my fourth step. And I didn't even get serious about that till the second child was born. So that would have been close to 10 years into the marriage. So we're doing this pull, tug, power struggle type thing, this piece.
He's sober at this point?
No.
Okay.
I think he's sober. His story is his story, but he was very good at living the double life that we all have to live when we have an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, for me, I'm showing up at church, I'm doing all these things, I'm doing all these mom things, and then I'm screaming, throwing things, and shooting guns off in the backyard at home. That's a double life. That's still that co-addict behavior of, he wasn't causing my distress, he was adding to it, but I wasn't choosing to do the self-care we all have to do to make those changes.
What kind of self-care would you be thinking about that would have been appropriate at that point?
So one of the biggest lessons, and it was a really simple lesson, is I went to my Al-Anon group and I said, I can't just stay up till all hours in the night waiting for him to come home, calling his friends, looking at the bars, all those types of things. I have an infant and a three-year-old. I have to go to bed. And they said, oh, honey, you cannot live your life based on what he does or doesn't do. You have to set boundaries. And they clarified for me what a boundary was. So I thought boundaries, and you'll love this one, I thought boundaries was telling him where to be, how to do it, when to get there, and what would keep me safe, right? That's what I thought boundaries were. Well, he's 250 pounds. What was I going to do if I even found him at a bar? I wasn't going to pull him into the car or put him in there somewhere. That wasn't going to happen. Boundaries are things that you can control. So in that situation, the only thing I could control was when I went to bed, when I got up. And, you know, the downward thinking spiral goes, but what if he's dead on the highway? And what if nobody knows? And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, the other piece of learning that happened that evening was, one, I needed to go to bed at a reasonable time so I could get up in the morning and take care of my kids, which were the ultimate at that point. And then two, I had to give him the dignity to be the man that he was, which this sounds really harsh. I had to give him the dignity to die in a ditch if that's what he was going to do, because he didn't marry a mother. And that's one of the things that I work in with my clients a lot is, do you want to be parenting your husband or partnering your husband? So parenting is up here, right? So I'm walking around like marionetting what's going on, or at least trying to. You know, he's living his own double life. But in partnering, back to Jerry Maguire, what I think they were trying to say was, I'm willing to be your partner no matter what it takes. So there's the line. I finally came up with it. Is,
well, hey, it took you a long time to finally answer the damn question. I mean,
I'm a slow thinker. I told you. I miss it sometimes.
But you came up with a good answer. You came up with a really good answer.
Right, right.
So your journey has been one where you've been part of a 12-step program.
Yes.
And that's helped.
That I cannot say. I know there's a lot of poo-pooing around the language of the 12-step program right now. We're moving away from the word addict to loved one to, you know, even codependency. We're moving away from that. I was just reading a book called Prodependency, and I like his premise because people who are loving someone who is struggling with the more overt pornography, you know, sex addiction, substance abuse, all those more overt ones that society up until lately has criminalized. The last thing they need is somebody to go, you're doing everything wrong. Well, maybe, but I need you to help me to do my self-care so that I can pull out of that. So I started with Al-Anon, and then we moved on to Celebrate Recovery and helped start one in our small little town. And Celebrate Recovery is a Christian-focused 12-step program that connects biblical truths with the 12 steps. And if you know anything about the 12 steps and the Oxford group, it did have a spiritual background. And we even see it in the 12 step, you know, this is for me to continue working out my own spirituality by helping other people. So we moved into that. I just celebrated 20 years last year. So I can't say enough about those programs. My sponsors, all the people who said, hey, we love you just the way you are. And we know you're screwing up. And we still love you just the way you are. That, I can't, there's no, and I know you've found a lot of relief there. There's no... How do you say it? If the opposite of addiction is connection, and what we do when we we do our addictive behaviors is we disconnect and we isolate, then that group comes in and they said, we know you are ready. It's okay. Share your truth.
The connection is so important. Smart recovery, Dharma, all different religious-based ones, or you know, your higher power, could be the people in the room. As long as you're connecting.
Yes.
The connection is really the important thing. And there's no wrong choice. As long as you're connecting with people. If it's helping you and it's giving you that support and balance, I think what you've done for yourself is remarkable. So your husband obviously is off on his journey.
Right.
And you decide you're going to adjust your own behavior. How have things, you said you were separated for 23 months or so?
That was 13 years ago. So okay. We're now raising boys 17 and 19 now. What we had to be careful of was each person was on their own journey and to respect that part of the journey. If you look at it, we were already leading pretty separate lives when we got to this crisis point, which I call cops, courts, and chickens. So we had 400 chickens at the time, and the court got involved, and life turned upside down. And anybody who's been involved in the court system in any kind of domestic violence or anything like that knows that the court sees one way to go about this. And that's why, bless their pea-picking hearts, all these drug courts, all these things, they're trying. But like you and I have discovered, everybody finds their own path. And what does that look like? And when the court impinges on you and tells you, you have to do this, that's when the rebellion comes out, and it's not the choice. Because what does the big book say? It's those that are unable to be honest with themselves, which are the poor souls that don't make it out. So if you've always got this big brother, so you've got wife who's saying you must do this, then court saying you must do this, do you clean up your act? No, you blame everybody outside of you. So we came back together, we're raising boys together, and I kept learning that the most underserved group was the family. So if you think about it, if you pluck this person out and send them to a treatment center, right? Then where do they come back to? They come back to this family who is still basically the same. Maybe they had a week somewhere, but what I wanted to do was be ready when he was ready to turn his life around. Because I knew when you stand at the back door and look at your husband and go, Jesus is coming for you and you better get your life together, you're on the wrong page. You're absolutely on the wrong page. And we had some pretty, you know, I don't want to trigger anybody, but we had some pretty serious physical altercations, which I think the deepest part of my own story is he had come home, and we lived 22 miles from town on 20 acres with 400 chickens. And he had come home, and I had asked him to get milk. I have young boys. He came home with tobacco. Really? Well, I was going to second shift work because he did the first and then I did the second, so we didn't have to have childcare. And literally, Corey, we were standing at the car door and I went after him with everything I had. Had I had a weapon, had he been a lesser man, I would have killed him. And I know that for certain in the depth of my gut. It was snowing. He very gently put me down on the snow. I laid there and cried for a little while and then went and called my sponsor. And my sponsor, bless her heart, what she said was, your kids need you. You in jail and your husband dead is not what your kids need. You will never do this again. We need to do your fourth step. So even those of us that don't have the substance, don't have the blackouts, don't have that, we are still in this muddle of non-understanding of what we really need. And those bottom moments still happen. And I think the family forgets that it's not, okay, if they go away for 30 days, they get fixed, we're all going to be okay. It wouldn't have been okay. Because you know with your own sobriety, you don't come back and go, okay, I can handle life now. You come back and you learn it bit, by step, by step. So if the family doesn't get ready for this to happen, the person comes back. This is the sad part. This is where marriages end. The person comes back and they say, my sobriety is the most important thing. And the wife goes, what do you mean I'm not important? What she doesn't understand is that if he doesn't keep sobriety, he can't do all the other things. But she's been set aside, pushed aside, put out, done all those things for so long, and has forgotten who she is. She has no idea who her identity is, because remember the first circle? She's the fixer. Well, he no longer needs to be fixed. Maybe he didn't need to be fixed in the first place. So now what's her job? She's out of a job. When we're out of a job, who are we?
Yeah, the family is the patient, and the patient is the family. And it all works together. When we do interventions, Arise Interventions is a great program, Judith Landau. And I studied with the Judith, plug for Judith. And they talk about the fact that successful intervention doesn't necessarily result in the patient going to treatment.
No.
It results in the family understanding how the family's behavior needs to be.
Right.
And hopefully, ultimately, that which is outside of your control will do what you think is best, do what is best for that person. And, you know, when the person gets sober, the family's got to be ready for it. And you eloquently set forth why that's so important.
And the other piece that we're beginning to study as a community is that connection piece we talked about, that people whose families do see themselves as people who can change, that personality is not permanent, that they can look at this differently instead of making that person who, yes, may have caused a lot of destruction in the family, but they've also made them the dumping ground instead of taking on responsibility for themselves. Long-term sobriety is more often available to the person whose family says, hey, yeah, we didn't like the behavior, but we love you. We have always loved you. And that, to me, is the whole God concept of, you know, it's not what God says you can't do. It's what God enables you to do because of grace, because of a gift, because of coming in and saying, he filled all those needs. I love you unconditionally. You're worthy, and you're never alone.
You're leading me into, I did some homework because you and I met today for the first time. You know, we don't know each other before today, but I read up, and I know that when you deal with your patients, I should say clients probably.
Yeah.
When you deal with your clients and you do your coaching, you have three different programs that you work on. It probably comes out of your own experience.
Yeah.
That you have these three approaches. The first one, I'm going to let you talk about it, but the first one relates to boundaries.
Yes.
And it's a good place to jump in. Talk a little bit about, you know, what you do in that coaching experience.
Absolutely. So back to my own experience of, I thought boundaries were things that I put on you. So I had to come back to boundaries were things that I could control. What can I control in my life? My attitude. If we get down to Viktor Frankl and the concentration camps, the only thing he could control was his attitude, and that's what he decided. So what we work on is, hey, where have I stepped across the line? Where am I trying to take care of things that are not my responsibility to take care of? Where do I need to do some more self-care? And where do I need to say, that's not okay, and I'm going to vote with my feet, or I'm going to say I'm not going to participate in that? Because, you know, my husband could still do some things, and I could say, well, all right, I can probably live with that, but I'm not going to participate in that. So one of the things I also learned in program was people aren't ready until they're ready. And maybe you're not ready to set some of the higher level boundaries. So I work with women where they are. Maybe you're ready to say, like I did, well, I'm sorry, I'm not going to wait up for you. I'm going to bed at 11. Or I'll put dinner in the fridge, but the kids and I are going to have dinner at 6 so I can run the household. And you start with these little bitty ones and build up to the next ones.
That's really good. And do you find, is that I think you call them empowered boundaries?
Mm-hmm.
And is that a program that is a when you work with your clients, is that a month-long, week-long, or is it an ongoing type of thing?
Thanks. That's a self-driven one. So you can pick that up at any time. You can work through it. It has videos and worksheets and all those other things. And then it has an opportunity, if you want, to talk out your particular situation. I'm not saying your situation is the same as everybody else's. I'm just saying there's some commonalities that hit all these places. And then we would work together personally if that's something you want to do.
So it's like a bespoke kind of program.
Yes. Yeah.
That's great. And there are a couple of other options that clients have, if I'm understanding correctly. Can you talk a little bit about the other two programs? You have a GRACE.
And Recovery, yeah.
And Recovery. That sounds really interesting.
So I'm in the middle of that one right now. We just did our sixth week for one of the groups that I'm running. I am always floored by how wise people are about their own lives when they're given the opportunity and space to think it through. So that one is 12 weeks long. We meet weekly as a group because, as you and I have talked about, Al-Anon, AA, Celebrate Recovery, there is a synergy in the group and you're bringing in great information. So with that one, we do a lot. We talk through the Gabor Mate. We talk through family systems. We talk through how you came into the marriage and what you feel like you wanted and what were the confusions around that. Some folks are dealing with kids as well, but a lot of it harkens back to, this is what I keep finding over and over, is the women will say, I lost myself. I want to care for them. I want to care for this child. I want to care for my husband or my ex-husband or whatever relationship, but I lost myself. So I'm this empty cup trying to pour into somebody else, and I keep shaking it up and down, and there's nothing to give. So we start with DeMartini's values. What are my values? If I could do anything I wanted, and it's not really about careers or things like that, but what are my values? Is it about trust? Is it about honesty? Is it about family? What does that look like? So we start with values and then walk all the way through what you were given as a child, and right now they're working on reparenting themselves. So were there some interactions that set up some core beliefs that you don't want to believe that anymore? You want to shift that. And then in there, woven in there, is 7 steps to positive communication. I'm also a CRAFT instructor, which I don't like the name, but it's community reinforcement training, and it focuses on the family. And like you were saying earlier, it's not necessarily about getting them into treatment. It's more about understanding, where's the pain? What are they moving towards use for? What are they moving away from connection? What is causing that? Because oftentimes we'll look at it and go, oh, well, I wouldn't come home to me either if I snapped all the time and threw things or said, you're an awful person. And we're doing it. I did it out of my own. I rejected you first before you could reject me. So right. You walk through the door and I'm like,
And is the 12 weeks is all virtual?
12 weeks are all virtual. I don't run any lives at this point. I have run lives in the past, but I don't run any lives right now.
Okay. Now, the third area, the third program, the third course that you provide, I found most interesting. It's, correct me if I'm wrong, prayer for your husband.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, that's a fertile ground for comedy, but I don't want to go into a funny type of thing.
We could.
So talk a little bit about that course and what that involves and why that's one of the three courses.
So worry is praying for things you don't want. And this, my mother actually gave this to me. She was a prayer warrior. Now, she could be in this room with us and happily not say a thing for probably the next 4 or 5 hours and really have gotten a lot of benefit, but you're not going to hear from her. So as you can tell, I'm not an introvert. And I took from her that lots of things can be done and yet unsaid. So this is about how do you get on your knees before God and what do you pray for? A lot of times we treat God like a Coke machine. We're like, okay, if I do 50 rosaries and I put in this and I put in that, and don't get me wrong, I'm I'm a Catholic sympathizer, so I love it. But if I put in this, then you should produce this. So we do this contractual relationship, which is what we're trying to have in our marriage. God doesn't work that way at all. It's all about grace. It's all about love. So these prayers are how to lovingly pray for your husband when you're basically ripping your hair out and pretty much are at the end of your rope. And they're 30 seconds long, and they can be done at a stoplight or any place like that. But it's what we talked about earlier, that attitude shift, that if I focus on everything that's wrong, that's really what I'm going to see. If I focus on even the few things that are right, which is what these prayers bring into you, then I can begin to start to work this out with God. Let me tell you another interesting thing about God. Wives are often in the way. So God's like, look, I need to be able to get to him, but you keep doing all this stuff and cleaning up all this mess and making all this better. And we keep going, but isn't that my job? No, your job is to turn to God, to be with God, and to follow God in your marriage. It never says, it says to respect your husband, but it never says to be his savior, to clean up all his messes, and to make sure that he is connecting and doing all the right things. Because, like I said, we're not this enmeshment. We're two individuals making a whole.
It would seem to me that you could do an incredibly good job with husbands as well as wives. That is to say, I know you're focused on women, but there's nothing that you've said that wouldn't apply the other way as well.
Correct. And think about program. Who do you want to hear from? You want to hear from somebody like you, who you know, like, and trust, right? It's possible, but there are so women. I'll give you this little thing. So you give a man a fish, you feed him for the day. You teach a man the fish, you feed him for his lifetime. You teach a woman to fish, and she teaches the whole community. So my focus is on women because oftentimes they are the connectors. They're the ones who's holding the cement. So they're going to go and teach their children. They're going to go and teach their parents. They may not be able to get to the man. Now, men could do it too, but that is often the women's focus, especially in a more traditional Christian home, is the heart piece, holding that together.
My point, I think, was you're absolutely right. That's the way it is usually. But the issues are exactly the same. There are men that suffering with the same issues with a wife who's addicted. And, you know, all the skill sets that you're teaching, all the skill sets that you've learned yourself, exactly what goes on the other way. But I would agree with you that, you know, if you were to take a poll, you're probably a little bit lopsided as to which way it usually goes. But, you know, people are people, and, you know, we can all be really together. We can all be really nuts. Hopefully, we all learn how to do it better.
Right, right.
That's something that I think time is also a big factor with that, because you can't snap your fingers with any of this stuff and have it happen.
No, and that's something that I teach my children, especially so. We're a very homogeneous community up in the northwest of Colorado. And I look at them and I said, look, if you cut any of us, we all bleed the same color. Our organs all work the same. There's no difference. So I don't see that. You're absolutely right. It's a matter of just niching down. There's only so many people that I can comfortably get to. And women are the calling right now, at least.
Right. I think it's wonderful. And the lucky ones are the ones that you talk to. Because there's nothing like having your own experience to be able to share. And personally speaking, the reason Irene and I do Crosstalk is because it helps us. And we're hoping to be able to give it away. And, you know, You can't keep it unless you give it away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that was it. Dr. Bob or Bill, who said, I have to keep talking to people. I have to keep sharing. And I learned so much. So when I run these small groups, I'm getting as much value out of it as the folks who are in the groups, because they are just bringing new and different things every time.
So 13 years ago was a long time ago. I think that's what you said. Mm-hmm. That was when. So how are things now for you?
So we're at, you've been here because yours are in the 30s. We're at that cross point. We've had one move out of the house. We've got 2 more years with the other one. And we're at that cross point of rediscovering each other, of going, we've been doing this for a long time, raising the kids. And what do we want to do next? What's the next phase in there? So we both run businesses. We've both been extremely busy with kids and football and basketball and all that stuff. And we're figuring out what the next, I don't think a marriage just has one contract. I think there's 3, 4, 5 renegotiations. You know, the new baby comes along, new negotiation. Maybe you move for a job, new negotiation. So we're at that phase of no more kids in the house in a couple of years.
Transitions are really difficult for everybody.
Yeah.
Transitions, you know, you go from the beginning to seniors, and there's no phase that's really that easy, because change is difficult. And I'm thinking of, you know, my folks and a woman for whom I care greatly about and care for, who's close to 90 right now. Her change of life right now and the different things she can do and she can't do are alarming. And when you're little and you go from, you know, kindergarten into first grade, or, you know, all the different stages. And for relationships, husbands and wives, when kids go to college, you know, that's a period of time where, you know, you really find out, you know, what's going on, and got to move into different territory together in order to be able to withstand those transitions.
Absolutely. Well, and I think it's the building up of each other, of what we were talking about, of there's a lot of negatives. I have a lot of negatives. He has a lot of negatives. If we continue to see those negatives, we're just going to start tearing things down. But if we begin to see the positives and start building and saying, oh yeah, that might be fun too. And that's where the family with the addiction has to look at themselves. Can't just keep be looking over here in this corner and one person. They also have to look at themselves and go, well, why was it easier for me when they were using, or they were out of the house, or this? Why was it that what value did I get from this? Because they do. And we don't like to see that, but we do get value.
Yeah, we have to look at our own part in things. What is that we've heard so many times when you're pointing at somebody, there are three fingers.
Back at you.
Yeah, exactly.
Not unless you point this way. Actually, this way.
Speaking of pointing, one of my favorite comics of blessed memory, when somebody comes out and they get introduced, everybody claps. And what does the person who is being introduced do? They go like this, right? Sorry, yeah. Sit down, calm down, stop clapping. Well, one of my favorite comics, Gilbert Gottfried, used to come out and used to go like this.
More.
And he'd do that for about 10 minutes. But the pointing, you know, you can apply the pointing in a lot of different ways. I have no idea what that had to do with.
Well, here's in the Christian tradition, it is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Excuse me. And love your neighbor as yourself. Somehow, and I can't speak for everybody, but somehow in Western society, and especially with the women I work with, they've forgotten that love yourself is in there. They're loving everybody and taking care of everybody, but not, you haven't been to the doctor. They haven't done something for themselves in a long time, whether that's sit down and have a cup of tea or go out with a girlfriend. They haven't done that. So the key component, just like this pointing, I'm glad you brought that up, is, okay, if I'm pointing at you, then I'm pointing back at me. But if I'm loving you, am I loving me too? Where did we get confused that that's important as well?
You know, and a kind of a cousin of that principle, my friend Amy, who sat in our crosstalk interview, was talking about not getting the response from one of her children that she expected, that she was being honest in all of her affairs to the best of her ability, but one of her children was not.
Mm.
And we were talking about it and talking about the fact that the golden rule is, you know, to do unto your neighbor as you would have them do unto you. There's nothing about the golden rule that says what they have to be doing.
Correct.
You're not controlling what they're doing.
Right.
You can only take care of yourself, loving yourself, doing the right thing, doing the next right thing, as we like to say.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever everybody else does is what everybody else does. And hopefully it'll be in line with something that works well in the relationship. But if it doesn't, I guess, you know, you just have to accept that and just keep doing the right thing. And whatever anybody else does, you're not going to be able to control all those things. It goes to the boundaries. It goes to all of the different issues we're talking about being able to just find ways to feel balanced, feel happy yourself, instead of having yourself dependent on what everybody else does in order to get your own satisfaction.
Absolutely. I interviewed a beautiful woman, and for the life of me, her name is not coming to me, but she says, when I love me, I set everybody else free. So I'm not demanding of you. I'm not demanding of my spouse. I'm not demanding of my children. That doesn't mean I don't want connection and I don't want to spend time with them. It means I'm not making that the pinnacle of how I feel worthy and valued.
What a relief.
Oh, well, just think about it. This is where I go against a little AA stuff is the family is not powerless. Now, we're powerless to control another person, but we do contribute. And we can contribute negatively or we can contribute positively by how we use our power. So I'm not power. I don't just look at him and go, well, I'm powerless. And so I walk away. I have a lot of power on how I interact, how I behave, how I choose to be in this person's life. So, you know, maybe you got a kiddo that can't live with you, but you can take him out to dinner. You can spend some nice time with them, you know, or maybe you've got a situation that they can live with you, but it's not forever. Well, you set some boundaries around that, things that you can control. You know, you do have a lot more power, and that's really the crux of it. When I get down into the deep passion of doing this, it was for those little boys in my life. And there's other little boys and little girls in other people's lives. I have parents call me and they say, what do I do? And the first thing is, are you taking care of yourself? And then are you loving on them and saying their responsibility is to be a kid? I've got a client right now at the Betty Ford Children's Center, which if you don't know about this, there's three of them in the nation. They do an excellent job of teaching about addiction in a way that allows the child to be angry with the disease and love the person. And it is just, it's thrilling to watch this happen because it frees the child to be the child, not the parent. Lets the child know you can't cure it, you didn't cause it, you can't control it. You do contribute, right? But this whole program is designed, and you should interview them. This whole program is designed so that the kids do a little section and then the parents do a section and then they do some things together because addiction in a family is devastating. So they're able to cut through some of the denial, some of the disconnection, the dishonesty, the lying. Now, this is a lot around substance abuse. I hope they'll expand at some point. But they have videos online now. They have workbooks they'll send out. So if you are a parent watching this, contact the Betty Ford Center for Children's Program. Get on that and work with them.
And speaking of how to contact, if somebody wants to contact you and find out more about your coaching and the programs that you offer as coach, where do they go?
If you want to know more about me, Sober on Purpose is my podcast. So out on all the great podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, all of those things. And then I am TanyaGioia.com, TanyaGioia.com.
Very good. So one of the questions that we like to ask our guests, I told you before we started, I was going to ask you something that I wasn't going to tell you what I was going to ask you.
Absolutely.
And now we're on.
Bring it.
All right. So if you had little Tanya being 6, 8, 10, 12-year-old Tanya.
Yes.
Right in front of us right now, knowing all the things you know now, with the experience that you've gained and the knowledge you've gained, what would you tell little Tanya in terms of kind of an advisory, kind of a thought or comment or advice?
I would hug her, tell her how beautiful she is, and that she's not alone, and that God deeply, deeply loves her, and that she's worthy, and that she is so loved no matter what she does. If she decides to ride horses or to paint pictures, or, you know, maybe if she pulls her sister's hair and gets in trouble, she's still loved and cared about. That doesn't take away that identity. It doesn't keep her from being that person.
Is there a question? That's a great answer, by the way. Is there a question that you wish people would ask you more times or more of, or something you'd like someone to ask you about you?
Me about me, huh? What brings you joy? It's probably a question I don't get asked very often. I do a lot of podcast interviews, but what brings you joy? And I think what I've found is it's those, my mother modeled it and I didn't see it right away. It's those little moments. It's when you're at the family dinner table and something just happens. Somebody says something off the cuff and everybody laughs to the point where milk's coming out of their nose and, you know, they're just pounding the table. Those moments or those quiet moments. I've been traveling with my son and a girlfriend. And so my son and I, who's 17 and 6'3", we're sharing a bed. But he got to tickling and pinching and doing all this to me. And we just were laughing. You know, it was those childhood kind of moments. Those little joy moments are, they talk about Mary with Jesus, of she tucked those things in her heart and she held on to those. And that's, it's not a big production. It's those little tiny connection moments that are so... I told you we went to Tanglewood, and if you haven't been to Tanglewood up in Lenox, Massachusetts, it's this beautiful, it's a lush green and beautiful music and concerts. It's something otherworldly, and it's just this little like snow globe thing. Those are the joyful things, you know, and they're often spontaneous, but some of them you can make happen. I mean, when was the last time you threw a tablecloth, put out your good china or your good dishes, and made a really fancy dinner just for your family? Not because company was coming over, because that's stressful. Just for your family. When was the last time you did that? When was the last time you took the time to say, hey, we're all going to lay on the floor with the dog and throw popcorn up in the air just because we feel like it? Those silly things.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes I think a really good question is, what are the things that make you lose track of time?
Mm.
And I like to say, you know, do more of those things.
Yep.
Sometimes figuring out what those things are isn't the easiest thing.
Yes.
I've asked that question sometimes to people, maybe, you know, somebody I might be sponsoring or somebody I'm trying to help. And, you know, they struggle with that. And sometimes it's nothing more than, you know, opening up a book, turning on some music, walking in the park, simple
yes.
stuff. But figure out what those things are. And by, you know, trying to do more of that stuff, we can find that joy. We had a guest here, I guess about a month or two ago, who had this idea that happiness was a scam. Because the idea of happiness is kind of like an advertisement for the best car. Or if, you know, if I have this, then everything will be great. If I get to that point mm-hmm. in my career, then I'll be happy. And his point was basically your point, stated differently, which is finding joy in the moment. That's where it's at.
So happiness is different. joy has a deep seat in my identity, and happiness can be very fleeting. You know, if you brought me a great tiramisu from one of these lovely Italian restaurants, yes, we would have some happiness for a little bit of time. But then, like any good sugar addict, it would go, phew, and I'd be on, you know, I'd be on the downward slide. Joy are these things that when I revisit that memory, it is still really joyful for me. And you have kiddos. So nursing those guys and looking down into their eyes is something I'll never do again. But it has just great joy of being able to connect at a bond that nobody else will have that level of bond with them ever, even when their wives come and take over and run their whole lives, right? That type of thing. Joy is not fleeting. Joy is deep-seated, and it rests somewhere between the heart and the belly. And yeah, I agree with him. The commercials of, well, if you drive this car, then suddenly you'll have this person in your life. Or if you get this job, then you can have that. We've all gotten to that level of, okay, I got this.
Doesn't do it.
No, it doesn't do it. I got it, and now what?
I'm Sergio's going to be bored by my saying this, but it reminds me that when I was, my kids were growing up, I'd always do really terrific things in kind of like, you know, trying to give them the most wonderful experiences, whether it was going on a Disney cruise or traveling to Circus Circus in Las Vegas or going to a baseball card show in Chicago or whatever crazy crap I might have thought was the thing to do,
right,
to make everybody, you know, really happy. My son related to me not too long ago that his favorite childhood memory was when he was really sick and had bronchitis, mm-hmm, and was blowing his nose and had temperature, came into our room, and he went like this to me on the side, and I got up and I walked into his room and we played board games all night, and I stayed up with him all night because he felt like shit.
Yes,
was his favorite memory.
Yes.
That's kind of, you know, approaches the same thing that stays in your heart and that doesn't go away, and, you know.
Yes, absolutely. It's when you do all this fancy stuff and they get everything they wanted and they're over there playing with the cardboard box that whatever the toy came in, they're just as happy, you know, cutting it out and building all those things.
Right.
And it's because you're there. You're the connection, which is exactly what we're saying about addiction. So the addictive behavior pulls you away into yourself in a non-healthy way that has long-term permanent issues and doesn't deal with the pain.
And the time that you spend, the connection that you make with other people, with your husband, with your wife, with your significant other, children, anybody who you love, the time you spend together, the connection is actually where it's at. It's not in trying to change how you feel using all these other things.
Right. Well, and don't even get me started about the gadgets and the phones and all those
Wait
things.
Just a second. Let me just take this.
Well, and I have a really darling memory. We were traveling with my parents and the boys and I, Jerry was at home somewhere, I can't remember why, but we were traveling and we had rented an Airbnb, but it was a tiny little one because we were only going to be there for a little while. And they walk in and they're like, there's no table. How will we have dinner? How will we eat if there's no table? Because Jerry and I had really focused on the family dinner table of sitting down and having dinner. They couldn't even conceptualize that you could have food and not sit down and face each other and have this conversation, which, quite honestly, Corey, I'm really proud of, because that's one of the things I want them to keep doing, is having that face-to-face and that connection.
And they'll do that. I'm sure they'll do that. Tanya, thank you so much for being on Crosstalk. I look forward to connecting with you in the future, doing other things together. And the way we usually end our episodes is we hug it out.
Okay.
I'm warning Sergio right now because he's got to get a camera up, because frequently he ends up with a picture of my butt, and I don't like that at all.
No pictures of mine either.